Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And I don't know how you characterize today's program, but
I'm not sure it's characterizable. It's got some different stuff in it. All of it important and interesting, and nothing more important and interesting. One of the world's great food and wine festivals coming up soon, and we caught up with Rob Black, the executive director of the Golden Gate Restaurant Association, who are the hosts and organizers for themselves, not with Food and Wine or Travel and Leisure or anybody else, doing it all on their lonesome in San Francisco, starting on the 28th, I believe, of July and going to the 4th of August. And we wanted you to hear firsthand from Rob what the festival's like, because I'm sure that when you hear about it, you'll want to sign up as fast as you can and get there, and we'll see you in San Francisco. So here's Rob.
We've been chatting before actually starting the recording with Rob Black, who's the executive director of the Golden Gate Restaurant Association, obviously in San Francisco, saying, I don't know that there's anything we don't like about San Francisco. We love it. We love the restaurants. We love the chefs, the personalities there. We love the shopping. We love everything, Rob.
That's awesome. That's wonderful to hear. I will tell you, today it is about 45 degrees and cold and foggy. So it's an unusual July for folks out in Pennsylvania, but it's our typical summer weather here, so I'm not sure if you'd like that as much.
No, I don't like the weather quite so much. And then the other part is you cross the mountains and you're into sweltering.
That is true. Right. You can, 20 minutes of driving any direction, you can get about any weather pattern you want.
Well, the last time we were in San Francisco, we were reminiscing about this just a few minutes ago, was Christmas time. We spent 10 days in San Francisco at Christmas time, and it rained almost every day.
I think so.
But we still had a wonderful time.
It's a truly magical city, and in different times of the year, while our weather actually does get teasing a little bit about the fog, it does get pretty beautiful and consistent almost all the time. But we do have enough change where the seasons really do take on a different magical quality.
Well, there's something about San Francisco also that must be the reason why there are so many wonderful restaurants there. It's such a wonderful dining scene. Do you know what that is?
I think it's a combination of a few things. One is the proximity to the Central Valley, and it is that going over the mountains and finding those farmers and ranchers that are doing really unique, beautiful quality organic foods. And our chefs really develop relationships with those producers. And you'll see them out in the farms, working with the farmers, helping them figure out exactly what they want in the restaurants. And the farmers really do cooperate and help deliver that product. So we have this beautiful relationship with kind of the farm-to-table approach to food that I think is unique, because we can get that year-round here in Northern California, where you can't in most places in the world.
And, of course, the wine.
And the wine the proximity to the vineyards is spectacular. We have also really developed, and again, using a lot of the local product, amazing distilleries and brewmasters now that are doing some really unique and interesting things around Northern California. So it's that combination of all of those things. And then you have a population that is kind of, San Francisco's known as the creative and innovative class of folks who gravitate here. And they tend to be very adventurous in their culinary approach.
Now, Rob, there's an approximate reason why we're talking about this today, and let's not forget to point that out at the beginning of this interview, because the great news, listeners, around the world, please, because this is a world-class dining destination without a doubt, you can join the fun, and you can get exposure to more San Francisco dining than you can at any other time of the year by showing up for an event that's coming up very soon. So tell us more about that.
Absolutely. So we are starting this is our fifth year of putting on the SF Chefs Food, Wine, and Spirits Festival here in San Francisco. It will run between July 28th and August 4th this year. And over the course of the last weekend, in particular, the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th of August, we take over Union Square right in the heart of San Francisco, tent out the whole square, and there will be about 230, 250 different restaurants participating throughout the weekend with tastings, demos, cooking competitions. So it's really an opportunity to taste and eat San Francisco in one weekend and get a great flavor of what's going on.
I thought the way you did it, and maybe you've done this every year so you don't think it's so special, but the tent tasting is dinner on Friday. I think, isn't it lunch on Saturday and brunch on Sunday?
We have four events. One is on the Friday evening, and so it's this year it's kind of the theme of that one is going to be around really the fifth anniversary celebration. We're going to have, I think, seven different pastry chefs cooking cake competitions where the people get to judge the cake, and then really a celebration of the fifth year of putting on the festival. The Saturday day event, which is a lunchtime time frame, is actually going to be a celebration of the five tastes. So each of the chefs that are participating in that tent event will celebrate and feature one of the five tastes in their dish.
What do you mean five tastes?
So,
well, sour, sweet.
Sour, sweet. Umami, which is one that it's,
oh, you mean,
funny
okay.
enough, not many people knew even existed for the longest time.
Right.
And still have, even people within the culinary industry or restaurant world aren't sure what that means. And so the chance to really experience those tastes with a chef who can walk you through what it means and what it tastes like, it'll be a very fun afternoon.
That sounds really
lunch.
Cool. Yeah, I mean, each chef, like at it has one of the tastes?
Exactly. So each chef will take on one of the tastes. They may actually have a couple of bites, so they may allow you to have a comparison within even at their own place, own station, about what the different tastes do.
Oh, that sounds like fun.
Yeah, so it'll be a really great opportunity to learn and experience wonderful food and drink. And we'll even have some of the cocktail pairings will have the different tastes highlighted. That evening, we're going to do a different type of approach to the Grand Tasting Tent than we've done in the past. Something that when you talk to chefs, and they're the ones who told us that they wanted to do this, one of the things that's really important to them is music. When you go into a kitchen, there's always music playing on the radio. Mm-hmm. They're inspired by that art, and because often these chefs are artists themselves. So on Saturday night, we're going to have the tent event is called Decadence After Dark. The menu is in the music. Each chef will highlight a dish that has been inspired by one of their favorite songs or bands, and then the soundtrack of all the different songs will be playing throughout the evening, but really showing where they get their inspiration for some of the creative food that they create. So that'll be Saturday night, and then Sunday during the day, starting at 11, we'll start it up a little earlier, and that's going to highlight Brunch by the Bay. So one of the things that's been really popular in San Francisco the last year or so, last 2 years, has been this big explosion of brunch. We're seeing really creative things happening at brunch, and so we decided that we were going to highlight some of the really great things happening. And it's also the opportunity to Bloody Mary class and enjoy, it won't all be eggs, but it'll be a good diversity of food, but we'll have that brunch component. So that should be a lot of fun as well. That's the first time we've done that in one of the tent events.
Now, at the beginning of the week, you have a dinner event that I don't know if it's even still available, but both the price and the content are what I would call gobsmacking.
It's a great charity event that we're putting on in partnership with the San Francisco Chronicle. It's called Masters of Their Craft, and it's really a celebration of the great female chefs and sommeliers and winemakers and restaurateurs of San Francisco.
Oh, great. So that's where the Women's Chef and Restaurateurs, I mean, they started in New York, but the real backbone of it was San Francisco.
Yeah, and it's really spectacular. Chef Nancy Oakes is going to host the dinner. It will be a 7 or 8 course dinner. We're still working out one of the maybe final courses, plus a whole dessert buffet afterwards. So really 9 courses. It's going to be a spectacular dinner on the Sunday, July 28th, starting at 5:30 at Prospect, which is one of Nancy Oak's restaurants. We're really excited about the idea of creating a space that celebrates some really great masters of their craft. And so it's also for a great cause. We're raising money for the Chronicle's Season of Sharing Fund, which helps fund individuals who are in a crisis situation, whether it's with housing or food security. So that's where the revenue from that event is going to go. So we're really excited to partner with them on that great event.
And this sounds like this is one of the great dinners that's on the annual calendar around the globe.
I think it will be. I think it will be one of the premier culinary events of the year. When you have April Bloomfield, who's now moving from New York to help open up her new place here in San Francisco, will open this fall. It'll be the first time she's cooking in San Francisco. Dominique Crenn, she's the first 2-star female Michelin chef in America, will be cooking.
She's fabulous.
She's amazing. Melissa Perello, Francis.
Yeah,
you can't get in that place. Sarah Rich from Rich Table. So it's just a wonderful group of exquisitely talented professionals who are going to be putting on a beautiful dinner that night.
Sounds really terrific.
Yeah, we're very excited about it.
Now, if you go through,
that is the 28th of July.
Are we going to that, Rabbit?
On the menu's budget doesn't go quite that far.
Well, we didn't mention that.
I was trying to make sure that some of our high roller listeners knew about it, so that they would make sure it gets filled. It's a little beyond.
You can make reservations and get further information on the website. Yeah.
Absolutely. So you can buy all your tickets and get more information on the website, which is sfchefsfoodwine.com. sfchefsfoodwine.com. And you can buy the tickets, get more information. We have after parties throughout on Thursday, Friday, Saturday nights. We have cooking competitions. We have educational programming. It's one of the things that we really do try to feature in our festival is the opportunity to learn. So we'll have classes from learning about herbs and how to use herbs, cut herbs properly, store herbs, to blending Napa Valley Cabernets, to making your own cocktail mixers, all sorts of different things that you can learn. And from some of the most talented chefs and bartenders in the country. So it's a great place to really get to learn something that you can keep with you for the rest of your life.
Well, it sounds exciting.
Yeah, we're still nailing down our final arrangements, but listeners, don't be surprised if you see us face-to-face in San Francisco, because we're certainly planning on it.
Well, I certainly look forward to it and seeing you under the tent. But it's a great celebration of what is unique and special about Northern California and the Bay Area, the synergy that takes place between our farmers, our chefs, our sommeliers, our winemakers, and frankly, our dining public, who loves to come out and be adventurous with their food and their palate and experience some of the most beautiful things that we have to offer here in Northern California, and that's our food, wine, and drinks.
And listeners, not all food festivals are created equal. The great thing about this one, I think, is that you run it.
Well, thank you very much, and we agree, actually. This is a unique festival in that it's put on by the local restaurant association, we're a nonprofit association, and so our focus is really about celebrating the sense of space that is Northern California and San Francisco, where our members are. While we're not focused on bringing out bringing in all the celebrity TV chefs, we will have Sean Brock coming out from Hawthorne.
Oh, he's a good friend. Yeah,
that's great. He's spectacular. So he's going to come out for the weekend. We have a few other chefs coming from New Zealand and other places. But we're really focusing, when we bring those chefs in, is to create both an educational opportunity for our chef. What they've asked is that, because we really believe this is their festival, this is something for our chef community, and they've helped us design it. Part of what they want from that as well is the opportunity to learn from other great chefs. And Sean is really a chef's chef. They really respect him and his skills, and so they were excited to have him out. And so he's going to actually do a couple of demos, one with Michael Tusk from Quince.
He's wonderful.
I love Michael,
what a wonderful
too.
Guy.
Yeah.
A wonderful guy.
I love him.
Yeah.
Love that
and
restaurant.
Just a spectacular chef. So they're going to be doing a demo on Saturday morning at 10 a.m. together. And then Sean is also going to do a demo on Friday for our all-day industry series with Daniel Patterson.
I love Daniel as well. Yeah.
So
I'm getting really excited now, Rob.
That's great. So there's some great personalities, great people, and great chefs. So it's an opportunity to really get to connect with them. And that's the other thing that's really great about the festival is when you go to the tent, it's not their sous chef. Well, their sous chef might be there as well, but the chefs are always in the tent. So it's your chance to ask them questions, to engage with them, and we really keep the level of food to both customers and to wine very high, because we really want to keep that celebration of the food. So while we'll have great wines and great spirits in the tent, our percentage of restaurants to customer is as high as you'll find in any festival in the country. So you don't have to wait for a bite. You can always walk up, get something to eat, talk to the chefs directly, and it's just a really great, intimate, fun experience.
In two words, Rob, be there.
Absolutely.
Look forward to seeing you, and thank you for joining us today on the menu.
And we'll meet up at the festival.
Peter and Anna, I really look forward to it. Thank you so much for the opportunity to talk to you today.
So once again, listeners, don't forget to explore going to SF Chefs 2013, and we'll be right back with more interesting stuff right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're listening, of course, to Ann and Peter Haig at On the Menu Radio, and we're glad you're with us this fine Sunday morning, and we're staying left coast for the next two segments again. It's amazing how they seem to do things first out there. I don't know whether it's first or best or whatever it is, but certainly when it comes to the world of beans, a very interesting character and his family got involved in making better beans, and here's their story.
We have a treat in this next interview. We're meeting the Bean Queen Hannah and her father, who's not actually called the Bean King, but he's called Dr. Bean.
Professor Bean.
Keith Kohlberg. And you have an interesting story. You're on the menu because we fell in love with your product, which is, of course, beans. But tell us, back up and tell us how you ended up getting in this business. You were not like a food professional to start with, were you?
No, I was not. And actually, Better Bean traces its beginnings to over 30 years ago, back in my college days when I loved to travel to Mexico and was a vegetarian. In Ensenada, Mexico, I fell in love with their bean cones down there. And if you ever go to Ensenada, you got to try them out. It's basically like an ice cream cone, except the cone is made from a tortilla shell, and they fill it with these delicious refried beans.
Oh, I would love that. I noticed you talking about it, but I've never seen it.
Well, if you do a search on Google, it's the only place in the world that has bean cones.
Oh, okay.
But the problem with their bean cones, I discovered as a vegetarian, is that their beans are fried in lard. And so I wasn't happy about that. So I came back, invented a recipe for refried beans that was vegan. It was sautéed in safflower oil,
uh-huh.
And it actually, I thought, tasted better than the Mexican version. And so that's where we kind of got our start in terms of our recipe. And then for years, raised my family on it. My daughters fell in love with them. My friends did. And everyone were amazed at how good beans could taste, because it was nothing like sort of the canned beans you get in the store.
Yeah, I love your titles. I mean, that the uncanned, what it
was. Uncanny refried black beans.
I love that.
Yeah, and then rethought red beans.
Yeah, rethought red beans. I like that one, too.
And we call it rethought because we've rethought everything about them. And so anyway, and back in 2008, during the Great Recession, like many Americans, I found myself wondering what I could do next. And one day I asked myself, what do I have to offer the world? And this little light bulb turned on in my head, and I said, well, people really like my beans. And thought, well, you know, I'm going to kind of check that out, because I've always been frustrated that when you go to grocery stores, all you have are canned beans, that they're convenient, but they don't taste very good. And then, of course, you can get dried beans that you have to cook. And I felt that people really appreciate a ready-to-eat, fresh, delicious bean, and knew nothing about the grocery industry, but I kind of pitched the idea to some people, including Lisa Sedler, who was CEO of New Seasons, a local market chain out here in Portland, Oregon, and she thought it was a good idea. And so that's how the business was launched. We decided that we were going to bring the world a better bean, and the company was named by my younger daughter, Brooke, and we spent half a year trying to figure out what to name it, and then one day she said, why don't you just call it Better Bean, Dad? And,
wonderful.
Smart girl. Now, does she work in the business, too?
Actually, she does not as dedicated. Hannah's kind of a 60-hour-a-week person. Brooke's still in college, and summer she comes home to help us out with production and farmers markets and marketing and so forth like that. But
we do have a family culture of working together. My father started a few other businesses that we've helped with, and just always are really family-oriented around the kitchen, cooking together, cleaning together, doing our chores, and so it's pretty natural for us.
How many of you are there?
Just the two of us, actually, but our stepmother was involved in a previous business as well.
Yeah. Rocio, my wife, travels around with me to do shows, and she came back with me for, like, the Washington, D.C. Veg Fest, for the Seattle Veg Fest, and so forth like that. And she's a journalist and has a full-time job, but she loves pitching her beans on weekends.
How do you start? Do you start with fresh beans, or you just start with dried beans?
Well, we start just as a home cook with dry beans, and then we get fresh ingredients. We get things like onions, tomatillos, jalapeno peppers, and so we cook the beans up, and then we have a unique step in our process that other companies don't have, is which we call our sauteing step. So our beans are actually sauteed, And if you could imagine, I don't know if you eat meat, I'm not really a meat eater, but if you eat meat, you can imagine the difference between a barbecued steak and a boiled steak, how they would taste.
Oh, sure, sure, absolutely.
And it's the fact that we saute our beans is one of the reasons they taste really, really good. It makes a huge difference.
And you also add, you undoubtedly add a variety of spice flavorings as well, right?
Yes, we do. And maybe, Hannah, you could tell about vinegar, one of the things that we put in our beans that really makes a big difference.
Yeah, I thought you lime juice, too. Didn't you have lime juice in something?
Yes, we have lime juice in three of our products, and then they're all finished with apple cider vinegar, and that really brightens the flavor, which allows us to use about a third of the sodium of a typical canned bean, which is huge for consumers, and also breaks down the oligosaccharides in the beans. Those are the indigestible starches, and so our beans are a lot easier on the system, and it's actually pretty funny. I've been starting to, the last 2 years, I've lived only on better beans, and recently I've started cooking my own beans again. I feel the effects.
Oh, really?
The regular beans, I'm like, oh, wow, this is real. That's why people are scared of beans.
this brightening of an acid like vinegar, and lime is particularly popular now. I could taste it in your black beans noticeably in there, and it's really on trend. I mean, I just did the Fancy Food Show, and that was one of the characteristics, one of the trends. I don't know why it's taken people so long to figure out that it brightens flavor.
Now, let's get down to basics. You have several different packages.
Mm-hmm.
Go over the flavors that are available.
Our original product was what we call the rethought red beans, and again, we call them rethought because everything's been rethought about them, the packaging, the fact that they're sold fresh, not in cans, sautéed, not boiled, sustainably sourced ingredient, artisan recipes, and so forth. It is a mild, classic Mexican-style refried bean that's perfect in tacos, burritos, nachos, huevos rancheros, and so forth like that. It has won juried Kids Picks Award. You know, kids like it because it's mild. Our next flavor is our Cuban black beans, and our Cuban black beans are made with a sofrito of onion, poblano pepper, coriander, and oregano, and again finished with the lime juice, and we've had Cuban Americans tell us they taste exactly like grandma's beans.
Oh, wow.
And they're really delicious, but they're not overpowering in their flavor, so that you can use them as a recipe ingredient just like you would, you know, just plain black beans. So you can make black bean soups, you can do rice and beans, you can do bruschettas, you could do stir fries, all kinds of things with our black beans. So those are our two mild flavors, and then our next flavor, which I'll let you describe that one, Hannah, because you're the one that came up with the name, the system chili.
I'm a food system, food movement nerd, and so I decided, why don't we call our chili, Three Sisters Chili, after the Native American way of cultivating beans, corn, and squash, their companion plant.
Right.
Beans fix nitrogen in the soil and grow up the corn stalk. The corn needs that nitrogen. The squash grow out and cover the soil and protect it from water evaporation and from weeds growing up. And so our chili has corn, beans, and squash. Unfortunately, they're not grown in this method, but they are sustainably sourced. And, yeah, our chili has really been very widely popular. It's a vegan chili, but has that really rich caramelized flavor that is characteristic of all of our products. And people are really excited to have alternatives that are gluten-free, vegan, soy-free, I mean, free of all these allergens. And so they really adapt our brand and become fans of us. And then our final two products are spicy takes on my dad's original recipe. We have a uncanny refried black bean that we also throw in serrano and habanero peppers into the mix. And so it has a really nice spicy finish. All of our products really evolve on your palate, so you taste just the bean at first, and then the flavor evolves and it finishes with this nice spiciness. And then probably the most popular right now, also very on trend, people love chipotle. So we have a Hobie chipotle bean dip finished with lime juice and the chipotle powder, which is smoked jalapeno, is, yeah, awesome. People love it with eggs in the morning. They do huevos rancheros or just eat it straight out of the tub as a bean dip. We also made a really great miso soup with it.
Yeah, you know what? I used it with soft boiled eggs for breakfast. It was a bit. It was a bit much to start the day with.
Didn't you put some lentils in
there? I think I had some spicy lentils in there too. It's a little overkill. But, how big is this business and what we're talking about? It sounds pretty artisanal at this point.
We have 6 full-time people and another 6 part-time people, you know, helping us with production. So, yes, we're a reasonably small family business out here in Oregon. We are right now in 15 states and 250 stores, but we've been growing very quickly. And we have made it out, as you know, to the East Coast, the Wegmans chain, and so we're kind of doubling to tripling every year in our size because people love beans, and in our case, we like to say they're easy, tasty, and healthy. And you can get canned beans. They're easy, but they're not really that tasty or healthy. Or you can cook them at home. It's tasty and healthy, but not easy. And with ours, they're easy, tasty, and healthy. And so we think we're empowering people to eat a lot more beans than they did before. And so
we eat a lot of beans. Yeah. Now, do you on your website, do you do internet fulfillment at all?
Because they're refrigerated, a fresh product, they're sold alongside the hummus and the salsa in grocery stores.
All right.
We're hoping to be available online in the fall via a online grocery delivery service, and we'll be announcing that. I have a lot of people who email me from all over the country. Can I have your beans? How can I get your beans? They're really excited about them, and we have this real chicken and egg issue with trying to get our beans to everybody, but also growing sustainably and in a way that we can manage.
Packaging is really nice. How did you come up with that? I mean, I've never seen anything in a package quite like it before.
The package is, we're proud of that, and it actually made the cover of Packaging Digest, so the package in itself has won some awards, and we're the first company to use that packaging in the United States. The packaging comes from Sweden, and it's a popular package style in Europe because it's sustainable, and it's convenient with that peel-off one-seal lid. It's kind of like the lid off a peel-off yogurt container, except that you can reseal it. And so, anyway, we're very excited to be pioneering that in the U.S., and the package in itself has gotten some great response. And Hannah, you did some sustainability studies on that.
We did a carbon footprint analysis, and this new container that we're using versus our old container, which was a typical round deli tub, represents a 30% reduction in footprint, so, you know, energy use, and that's the whole lifetime and production of the plastic, the container. But when we approached this project of redoing our container, it was because we would go into the store and we couldn't even find our own products. But people would come back to me at the farmer's market and be like, which one did I buy last week? I don't remember. We need bright colors. We need it to be very easy, stand out on the shelf and have that. We really were looking for a rectangular square tub to stand out in the sea of round tubs where it typically lives with the salsa and hummus. And we are really excited to find a partner in this plastic company who cares about the sustainability and thinking innovatively around packaging. And really their end goal is to make this packaging 100% post-consumer. There's some fairly sizable waste stream issues and production issues that they have to overcome first, and partially also they need more people, more companies to adopt this packaging before that will become a reality. But we're really happy to partner with a company who thinks like we do. And that's what we've really tried to do in all of our supply chain relationships is work with people who are trying to change the food system, not just stick with the status quo.
And with Better Bean Company products, the answer to the question, what do beans go with, the answer is they go with everything.
Yes.
Breakfast, lunch, dinner, and snacks. Beans are a great daily, or you should at least eat them a few times a day, and they have studies that have shown that, you can look it up on the internet, but people eat beans twice a week, weigh on average 7 pounds less. They have lower cardiovascular problems, lower cancer rate. It's a key element in the Mediterranean diet that's been proven to prolong, studies show, proven might be too strong of a statement, but I'm sure that
I would say
really, that.
Like everything else, depends on how much you eat. It's like,
yeah,
right.
Anyway. In and out. I'm one of those in and out calorie people.
Here's the last piece of advice for our listeners. When you find some in your favorite store, buy at least twice as many as you are planning to, because you'll eat them with everything. And they won't last.
That's very true. That's why they're so great.
We had 5 of your packages in less than a week.
Well, we're very honored. Yeah, people love them.
Yes. Well, good luck to you. Continued success and ever onward. And say hello to Portland, one of our favorite cities. And you're in a good place filled with entrepreneurial talent there, so that's great.
Thank you so much. We are very honored to be included in On the Menu.
Well, thank you.
And we'll be talking about more interesting foods from Oregon right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Thanks for staying tuned to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. As promised, we're bringing you more Oregon foods in the form of a well-established long-term family business with a family of products. We'll be talking to Dominic, an odd spelling, BG, and about his company, Beaverton Foods. We're finally getting to talk for the first time to Dominic BG, whose company, Beaverton Foods, encompasses a whole bunch of different things. Dominic, just give us some sort of encapsulated, whatever you'd call it, idea of what this company is all and what brands you cover and all that stuff.
I'll be glad to, and thank you for having me on air today. Yeah, the company started by my grandma back in the 1920s during the Depression. She originally started off with horseradish. She was a farmer, and that was her original crop. It was just horseradish for a number of decades. My dad got into the business in the late 1940s and 1950s, and he started diversifying us into mustards, originally starting off with a wet shelf stable Chinese mustard was his first. And he noticed that most of the specialty mustards were coming in from Europe, classic French Dijons and German whole grains and old English hot mustards, and he started developing products that were similar in quality to them, but the distributors and stores didn't have to buy thousands of cases and bring it over across the Atlantic Ocean like they did. So that's how he kind of got into mustards. And then he started developing unique flavors of mustard, putting honey into mustard. We're the first company to put honey into a mustard. And that was kind of been our niche, is developing unique, high-end specialty condiments. And we now have several brand names and 500 formulas of products, ranging from our Engelhofer brand, Beaver brand. We have a Pacific Farms brand, which is mostly Asian flavors, but we do a tremendous amount of Asian sauces, dressing, salsa, besides the mustards and the horseradish and various marinades and dressings
as
well.
You make them, but you don't grow the ingredients anymore.
Not anymore. We farmed up until the mid-1970s, and then we contract out with this family down in Southern Oregon, Northern California, that we get all our horseradish roots from now.
The ingredient for mustard is a ground mustard seed, right?
Well, yeah, mustard seed, and 80-some-odd percent of the mustard seed crop comes out of Canada. Okay. I kind of always joke that even the French get their mustard seed from Canada and give it the ooh-la-la, and then bring it back here to North America. So,
yeah, it's funny. We have a jar of mustard powder that we must have had for 25 years, and it says Canadian mustard on it.
Where is that?
Yeah, they do grow.
It's in where all the regularly used spices are.
Really?
I don't ever use it, but it is in there.
It's probably not very good by now.
and I have to admit, we actually have a little bit of Coleman's in the refrigerator too, but I suppose an Englishman's allowed to do that, I suppose.
I would say so.
So, besides mustards and cocktail sauces and horseradish, what else do you produce?
Oh, gosh. And we do a lot of co-packing for other companies as well. So that gets us into dressings and marinades and Asian sauces. Salsa is a growing category. Whatever, somebody needs something. But our customers are always looking for something a little bit unique and a higher quality. And we also have a very safe plant here. We're SQF. And we also can do organic items and kosher items and things like that, and all natural and all those kinds of hot buttons. Gluten-free is another big one that we're we're working on. We're also working on the GMO things that are becoming very...
Yeah, that's really big. I noticed the labels are just getting longer and longer and longer on these products.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
The gluten-free thing is like the fastest-growing, whatever you call it.
Tremendous consumer interest in that particular category, and we certainly are paying attention to it here as well.
Yeah, I was amazed at the Fancy Food Show how many good-for-you products there are and healthy, and so much attention to allergies.
Yeah, yeah, it certainly is. And we're getting it. I noticed that it's a lot more prevalent when I was back in the U.K. and Canada, but we seem to be catching up to some of those areas here in the States, and certainly there's a growing market for those kinds of items here in the States. And I think our consumers are just getting more and more educated on what their food is and what the additives are and what the ingredients do to their bodies. I think there's still a tremendous lot of education in nutrition and eating in this country, and I don't see that going away.
Now, you're quite an American success story, right? Because Grandma started the business when she came from Italy. Three generations later, you're still going. And
yeah,
you can still afford to produce these products in the USA, which is supposed to be so expensive to make?
Yeah, we watch our, always stayed smallish, never grew too fast, never went way into debt, just, you know, really managed the money very, very wisely, never got too big for our britches, and never needed a partner, quote-unquote, from a bank or a local government, and we just kind of did it the old-fashioned way, and we don't have jets and mountain cabins and expensive hobbies that we need to pay for with the company, so we... It's just, you know, we always say if we take care of the family business will take care of us. And
that's
we've always been very
wholesome.
Conservative.
That's really refreshing.
and is another generation coming along?
Yeah, I have my nephew here. He's 30, and he's the fourth generation. And my kids are just, you know, getting into college, and they're still a little bit young. But, yeah, we've certainly got the fourth generation. And it's kind of promise that my dad made to grandma and that my dad's made to me and that I made to my dad is that we'll try to do everything we can to keep it a family-owned business as long as we can. And if the next generation's interested, great. And if it's not, then we have some tough decisions to make. And that would be a sad day to have to sell off the company. But we certainly like to see one of the kids kind of step up and say they want to try and run it.
So that hasn't happened yet?
Not yet. I just, you know, just really my dad's still around and he still owns the majority of the company here. So we're just trying to get through from him to me here. So we get along really well, but it's quite a process to do legally and emotionally.
Family businesses are rife with problems.
No, it's a unique set of issues, shall we say?
Yeah, it certainly is, and certainly my dad and I get along very, very well, so there's no contention. But it's a onerous process under the best of the situations, and you know, somebody who's worked in the business like himself, you know, he's 85 years old, he's still very healthy, very active, very engaging, and very interested in the business, but it's hard for him to kind of just say, hey, I don't want to do it anymore, it's yours, take it and go. You know, very unlikely for that type of, it doesn't happen, so very normal what he's doing.
Would you change some things? Will you change some things when that happens?
Well, you always like to put your own mark. Somebody once gave me some advice, no matter what you do, don't try to be your dad and don't try to be your grandma or try to be your other relatives, try to be your own person and bring your own interests and your own strengths to it. But there's, I think the core foundation is the core foundation. We make high-end specialty condiments. That's what we do. We're not going to get into crackers and jams and chocolate or something like that. We're going to try and stay in the condiment category and take a look at our opportunities. And always, you always want to try and get things and see if we can fit them into what we do and be smart and make good business decisions.
And you've got a good, steady labor force there, too?
Yeah, we got 72 employees. I would say half of our employees at this point have been with us, you know, 10, 15 years or longer. I got several people, folks that are in their 50s, been with us 30 years. We've got an institutional knowledge of people here. It's really something. It makes my life a lot easier when you have people been with you such a long time, and we all know each other. We know how to work together, and it makes problem solving actually enjoyable. You know, we may disagree on where we're going to go, but at least it's good, vigorous conversation, and we don't take it personal. And when we disagree on where to go with something, and it kind of harkens back to kind of like a Star Trek episode or something. You know, you get all your smart people in a room and you hear all their opinions and then we make a decision and make it so. And sort of what we do here, and it makes it pretty easy.
It's a wonderful American success story. It reminds me, you remember John Falls when we were in Louisiana? This is a famous.
Oh, yeah.
You know John?
Yeah, John.
I know the names and I know the story, but a little bit, but not
He's
personally, no.
Absolutely amazing guy. He just one day, I don't know really why he explained it to us, and I've forgotten why, he decided to build a factory in rural Louisiana just outside New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the core of this particular community, and he knows everybody by name. They all hug him. They give him big kisses when he comes in.
He's a wonderful guy.
Well, it seems to me like you have the same kind of operation there. Management realizes that it wouldn't be there if it wasn't for the workers, and vice versa. So there's no conflict.
Yeah, it's a fine line to ride. But you know, I can't go down there and box and label and mix everything. So I got to rely on people and try and give them a good, safe place to work, and you know, keep the conditions nice. And my grandma always says, you know, that the easiest thing you should be doing is coming to work at Beaverton Foods. The hard stuff is when you go home, you know.
Ah.
Raising kids and taking care of a house and paying bills, that's hard work, you know. Coming here to Beaverton Foods, it should be easy. You know what to do and put your hours in and do a good job and hold your head up high and go home and then do the hard work.
Well, tell us this. Tell our listeners your website, which will give them a better picture of your company, your wonderful company.
Yeah, you just go to www.beavertonfoods.com. With an S.com.
Right.
And, you know, Grandma's Story's there. You can see all our items and awards, and we keep it pretty simple. And you can order product on it right online, too, if you're so inclined.
Great. Well, Dominic, I'll pronounce it the right way this time. Dominic BG, it's been just a delight to talk to you and to hear a good old success story. And we're enjoying enhancing the flavors of everything we eat with a little bit of this and a little bit of that and a little bit of the other Beaverton.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to share the story. Thank you very much.
Okay. Keep successful.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And we'll be back with another charming family business story right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.com. .net.
The last time we checked our world atlas, Noosa, New South Wales, was on the border, on the seashore of that country, and Boulder, Colorado is in the middle of these United States. So what do they have in common? Well, listen in and you'll find out.
Well, I've been finding all kinds of ways to use this wonderful Noosa yogurt, spelt with an H, which is how they spell it in England and Australia.
Now, is that Noosa or yogurt?
Yeah. So, but anyhow, I got the press release, and I'm talking now to Coel Tomei. I got the press release, and immediately jumped out at me was Noosa, which is this beautiful beach town in Australia.
Practically on the border of New South Wales and Queensland.
Yes. And I've made a snap back a reply saying, you know, I've been there, which I figured most people that you sent the press release to hadn't been to Noosa, and I in fact had, and it is beautiful. But then when you sent me the sample of the plain yogurt, because that's your newest product.
Mm-hmm, it is.
I was just blown away by it, and it came in this really huge container, and I thought, we're never going to get through this. And you know what? I think there's just a few inches left in the bottom of this huge container.
Yeah,
now.
We're almost done.
I absolutely love to hear that.
Have an interesting story. Is your name of Greek origin?
My name is actually an Australian bird. So my father is an ornithologist, and instead of looking in a baby book, my parents looked in a bird book.
And Coel is an Australian bird?
It is. It's a cuckoo bird, no less.
Oh, it is?
Don't tell anyone I told you that.
All right. It's not a kookaburra, it's a cuckoo.
It's a cuckoo bird, yes. Not to be confused by the laughing kookaburra.
Okay. And so you've had something of a jar. You call it a walkabout, which is what they say in Australia. Now, explain to our listeners what a walkabout is.
So it's actually an Aboriginal term. So they would obviously go on travel sort of over long distances, and it's sort of just become adopted into the mainstream culture of just having the zest to travel and go far, far away places. So most Australians, when they finish university, will go on what we like to call, you know, overseas walkabout.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, I lived in London. I knew a lot of Australians who were there doing exactly that. At the time, we didn't even know there was such a concept as a gap year. And I don't do Australians recognize a gap year? In England, they do. In the United States, they don't, I guess.
Not as much. It's typically after university that people will go on their sort of their walkabout. But it's funny when you talk to people like, oh, well, how long have you been on your walkabout? You know, mine's been now 17 years.
Okay.
Somehow you sort of stuck somehow. But tell us the story of how you got connected with Noosa Yoga, because that in and of itself is a rather fascinating story.
Yes. So I was home visiting my family in Australia, and they live on Sunshine Coast, which is home to Noosa. And I was just at this little corner shop, and I discovered this amazing yogurt, and it really didn't have any branding on the side of the container, but it was clear, so you could see the product, and it had passion fruit, which is really a quintessential Aussie flavor. So I picked it up, and I looked at the container lid, and thought, oh, this looks interesting. And upon tasting it, I was completely blown away. My now husband thought I was sort of crazy, because I was like, this is the best yogurt I've ever tasted in my entire life. And he sort of just chuckled and said, okay. And then he's already working in the food industry. And my
and
mom
you were
said,
already in the food industry.
Yeah, so I was already in the food industry.
Doing
Boulder,
what?
Boulder is sort of a hub for natural product companies. There's a lot of food companies that have started in this area. So it was sort of inspired by working in the industry, and my mom was like, you should call them. And so at her behest, I just out of the blue called the family owned business in Australia. It's actually Queensland Yogurt there. And I convinced them to have a long lunch with me, and I basically pitched Colorado as this wonderful place to launch natural food products. And somehow I convinced them over this long lunch that it would be a great idea. And essentially we went into partnership, and half of the Australian family actually came to Colorado and lived here for the first 2 years to get the business up and going. So it's amazing what you can do over a long lunch in Australia. You know, obviously there were a couple of lagers involved.
Yeah, there might have been. Now, what is it that makes it so special? I mean, it really is absolutely extraordinary. I mean, in years past, if I was sitting in Australia talking to my friends about it, I'd say this yogurt's bloody marvelous. But what makes it that way?
You know, I think it's just this perfect intersection between a traditional yogurt, which is, I guess, a little runnier in consistency, and the Greek, which is very, very thick. And we like to think of ours as just very uniquely velvety in texture. And then before we launched the plain, our core lineup is based on a honey-style yogurt. So it has this really nice sweet tart flavor profile, just not overly sweet but not too sour or tang. So I think we just sort of hit that right mark between a traditional and a Greek, and people have responded to it exactly how I did the first time I tried it. So it's very exciting, very exciting.
The family, it was a family recipe?
Yes, so it's the Mathewson family, so it was actually their grandma's recipe.
And did they have their own culture or not? You know, you need a culture to start your yogurt. And
it has the traditional yogurt cultures, but obviously in a proprietary blend. But it has five cultures, the Acidophilus, Bifidus, Kasai, and then I'm going to, now you're going to test me on my Greek, Haemophilus and Bulgaricus.
I see. Yeah, because it reminds me of when, back in the day, I used to make my own yogurt with a culture that came from Syria. We talked about Syria. And actually, I'd never tasted anything with that kind of a flavor profile before.
Did you bring the culture here?
So we worked with the same company that had been providing the Queensland family, their culture.
Oh, I see. Okay, got it.
Yeah. So you know, our tagline is Aussie culture, Colorado fresh. So that's just kind of a play on words that, you know, we're obviously bringing some of the Australian factor to the United States, and then you know, we're obviously produced in Colorado, which has a very sort of similar lifestyle and ethic as to Noosa. You know, just very easygoing, friendly. So it's a really nice intersection between the two cultures for sure.
No, it is a milk-based product, like yogurt is. So
it is.
So you have to be able to get a good supply of really good milk? Is that the secret, or are you not?
That's definitely part of the secret. So one of our partners is a family-owned dairy just north of Fort Collins called Morning Fresh, and they're, again, a family-owned dairy, have very high standards as far as how they raise their cows, and in essence, the cows are milked literally about 66 steps from where we actually produce the yogurt, so it's incredibly fresh, and as the single largest ingredient in the product, that definitely lends to a higher quality product.
Now, just in case people think that this is like a Kraft product and you can't find it anywhere, so why are we talking about it on the menu? One thing is very clear, that your background in the food industry turned out to be extremely beneficial, because you can find it everywhere.
Yes, and we've been, you know, again, I think we've been very fortunate with our product, because Greek yogurt has really driven the growth in the yogurt category, but a lot of buyers recognized that this was a very hot trend and that people were looking for new items in the yogurt aisle. So we've been very fortunate to have a lot of retailers sort of have that vision that while we weren't a Greek yogurt, we were a very delicious Aussie-style yogurt that really had a place on their shelves. So on that front, we've been very fortunate.
It's absolutely amazing, really, how Greek yogurt a few years ago was like 4% of the market. Now it's 33 1/3% at least.
It's what was that
amazing.
Guy? What's the guy?
It's
his name
amazing.
Fage, the guy? Was it?
Yeah, I can't
Fage, however you pronounce it.
Fage, and Fage. Then obviously Chobani has been
Chobani, yes.
An amazing success story as well. Yeah.
And then, of course, you can buy from Jamie Lee Curtis as well if you want,
well,
I suppose.
She's now doing Greek yogurt.
Yeah,
well,
exactly. Yeah. Yeah, she's doing Greek yogurt for
as well as
Danone. I said, I don't know. I don't know who she represents.
No, it's, I don't remember.
You don't remember. Okay.
Whatever it is,
has something to do with keeping you regular. That's about the only message coming across. Which doesn't sound like the most attractive way to deal with yogurt. My guess is if you had a slogan that said this is the best bloody marvelous yogurt in the world, you'd get your message through a lot quicker.
I know, and I suggested that as a tagline, but I think that was where the culture gap was a little too far between, you know, the Australians and my US partners. They were like, I don't think that sounds very appetizing.
So. Well, it's also a matter of whether or not you can put it out on the air, I suppose. The FCC doesn't care about what we do since we're not going over their airwaves.
But how do you get your yogurt, Noosa yogurt? Activia is the one you were thinking
Activia,
of.
Okay.
Activia. But how do you get Noosa? I mean, I saw you have not a store.
Oh, yeah, they have a store locator. Sure.
Oh, was
right
that
on the website.
The one that looks like a cow?
I can't remember.
Yes,
what it looks
so
like.
if you go onto our website, we do have a store locator. But we always recommend, you know, that people give their local store a cooey, as we like to say, to make sure that we're on the shelf and in stock. We've actually had people tell us that they've driven over 100 miles to go and find our product.
Really?
Because it might stock out, I guess.
Of how avid our fans about the product.
I thought we should mention that, because we've been talking about plain, and most people really like fruit. How many varieties, flavors do you have?
So in sort of the honey-based yogurt, we have 8 flavors. So we have the honey, which, you know, you can have straight up. Then we have blueberry, raspberry, have a mango, peach. We have award-winning strawberry rhubarb, which we're the only company in the United States that's actually doing a strawberry rhubarb.
That's my
flavor.
Fruit pie. I love that prize.
And it's, I guess it's sort of more of a traditional flavor in some aspects, but not so traditional in a yogurt. And people rave about that flavor in particular. And then we also have 2 new flavors. We have a passion fruit, which is my all-time favorite, which is obviously that very quintessential Aussie flavor, but a little more exotic in the U.S.
Yeah, I can't imagine how you can afford to make it with the passion fruit. And Whole Foods was like $4 a piece.
I know. They are very expensive. And they'll have a new lemon, which is fashioned after more of a traditional lemon curd. So it's probably the most indulgent flavor in our lineup. And then plain. Plain will be, you know, we're just launching that in August. So we know that our fans will be really excited to be able to get that.
Well, we can certainly give them an endorsement. I forget whether you sent us a quart or a gallon. but we're most
it was pretty big.
But we're most of the way through it, and we're not sharing it with anybody else. I can assure you.
We just eat it
all the time. I love to hear that.
It's my favorite yogurt. So
we definitely have some pretty great fans that will share stories with us, and a lot of parents will tell us that they're hiding their noosa from their kids, and should they feel bad about that? I understand the need not to share.
You can give them Dannon, for heaven's sake. they won't know the difference.
No, we want everybody to eat noosa.
Noosa can conquer the world, huh?
Well, Coel, it was great discovering this product and enjoying it and talking to you as well.
And thank you so much for joining us today on the menu.
Yes.
All the way from Colorado.
Thank you for your time.
Yeah.
Really appreciate it.
Let's set up and meet in Noosa. We're due to go back. So thanks again.
Well, thanks to you both. And as we like to say in Australia, hooroo.
It's all from On the Menu Radio for this week. We'll see you again same time, same place next week. And in the meantime,
bye-bye.